Yes, dear friends and colleagues, as we continue with the topic of domestic courts, we now change to the implementation perspective of all that international law stuff and advisory opinions and what we have. And please just at least be calm, if not be seated. As starting my international law career, the first thing I learned was international law is fine, we have all these principles and rules, but what about implementation? That's really the thing that matters, also with regard to the nuclear issue. And the second thing I learned, and I start teaching all the time, was what really matters is domestic implementation. It is okay, we have the United Nations system, we have international implementation procedures, reporting procedures, all sort of things, but what really matters is the domestic compliance. So it is, in the end, the role of domestic courts. And so we are happy to have this topic of the agenda now and a lot of panelists around me, which I will not introduce myself, just for saving time and also to give the chance to speakers introducing themselves. The first on the list is Phil Scheiner from Peace Rights, and I give the floor right away to you, Phil. A few words of introduction and then your intervention, please.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm going to speak this morning as a UK lawyer with practical experience of trying to litigate issues arising from the UK's possession of a nuclear weapons system. So I'll be speaking more with my litigation hat on. As a public interest lawyer where I practice this afternoon, I'll be speaking more with my peace rights hat on when I'm talking about people's tribunals. The experience I've had over the last few years involves cases in every court in the UK, from the High Court, the Court of Appeal, to the House of Lords, and a case in Strasbourg for Angie Zelter and others. But those cases have also brought me into contact with arguments arising from other cases, particularly cases for activists who've tried to use the criminal defence of necessity to shield them from the effects of deliberate damage to equipment or premises concerned with nuclear weapons. And I want to draw out, if I may, some lessons from that UK experience, which I think may be relevant to other jurisdictions. The first lesson is that in the UK, there is no question whatsoever that a court would ever rule on whether the UK's possession of its nuclear weapon system Trident or any decision to replace it is or is not in breach of international law. That is what we know in the UK as the principle of justiciability, the principle that says certain matters are matters of high foreign policy, defence policy, defence of the realm, security of the nation. They are not a matter for judge or jury. It's a simple separation of powers issue. There may be some confusion if I leave the principle of justiciability hanging there, and I ought to just note for our American lawyer friends that that would be more closely equated with what they would know as the political question. So that's the first lesson. So we're about to make a decision to replace Trident and spend £35 to £40 billion of UK taxpayers' money in replacing Trident rather than on our precious national health system. If CND or others intend to challenge that decision to replace Trident, because I believe that a decision will be made to replace it, in my view, they are absolutely doomed to fail. And just to give you a quote from the Court of Appeal, this is a case regarding the manufacture of nuclear weapons at Aldermaston. It's one of my cases, and one of our judges, I think, puts this principle of justiciability very well in making it very clear. He says, the graver a matter of state and the more widespread its possible effects, the more respect will be given within the framework of the Constitution to the democracy to decide its outcome. The defence of the realm, which is the Crown's first duty, is the paradigm of so grave a matter. Potentially such a thing touches the security of everyone, and everyone will look to the government they have elected for wise and effective decisions. Of course, they may or may not be satisfied, and their satisfaction or otherwise will sound in the ballot box. And there you have it. If you don't like these political decisions, then vote out your government, but don't come to this court. So that's the first principle. But that doesn't mean that that's the end of the matter. It doesn't mean that every time there's a question of law in the context of the manufacture of nuclear weapons or nuclear submarine bases in Fas Lane or wherever, that just because the government can press the button marked national security, that they can do what they want. That is not the case. There are four areas in which the court may be prepared to intervene. The first is where there's actual bad faith on the part of ministers. So, for example, supposing a minister had financial links to a contractor involved with the manufacture of nuclear weapons, and he or she made that decision, was part of that political process in making the decision to award a contract to that same contractor. The second area would be where basic procedural duties had been breached. Supposing our government had given on the record a clear public commitment for the fullest public consultation through whatever means before it makes this important decision as to whether to replace Trident. And having promised full consultation, it simply failed to give the public that opportunity. In my view, that would be a clear opportunity for activists or NGOs like CND to go to court and get the court to order that that consultation must take place. A third area is where a UK statute, had actually required the courts to review that type of high foreign policy or defence decision. And the fourth area, most importantly, is where human rights issues arise. If human rights issues are engaged in a particular issue, say, concerning Aldermaston, where we manufacture nuclear weapons, then immediately the decision maker has to strike a balance between the human rights of those who are having those rights removed and the needs of the state for security. And that's particularly important where rights are qualified. And by qualified, I mean that most of the rights in the European Convention of human rights are not absolute rights. The absolute prohibition on torture is an example of an absolute right, but most rights are qualified, and the state is allowed to interfere with those rights in certain circumstances, and the needs of national security is one of those circumstances. I'm involved in a case at the moment concerning whether the UK government can pass bylaws at Aldermaston to absolutely prohibit any organised protest or use of mobile phones, to make it impossible for peace activists who've been on that site for many years to continue with their lawful business in exercising their right of freedom of assembly. And from what I've seen of those bylaws, I understand that those bylaws go far too far, i.e. they are a disproportionate response to what the state is trying to achieve at Aldermaston, which presumably is less public protest because it's saying that those national security interests. So that would be an example of where the courts might be prepared to intervene, even though the context is high foreign policy and defence policy being the manufacture of nuclear weapons. The third lesson is, my experience is that it's an absolute mistake to claim too much of the ICJ opinion, or to try and argue that nuclear weapons per se are illegal, as they will, for example, necessarily breach the intransgressible principles. In my view, no such conclusion can be reached. We have to live with the fact that we do have a fudge by reference to the phrase extreme circumstances of self-defence, and we do have a fudge in that the court deliberately refused to rule on the policy of deterrence. So one cannot say that the policy of deterrence is in itself a threat to use nuclear weapons. However, my experience is that more nuanced arguments can be made and can be more successful. In the case that I just read from, the case about manufacturing nuclear weapons at Aldermaston, we wanted the court to look at whether the manufacture of nuclear weapons was in breach of the intransgressible principles of international humanitarian law. And the question arose in that case as to whether the Euratom Treaty applied to military uses of nuclear energy. The government argued that the Euratom Treaty, which brings with it the need for a full justification exercise, only applied to civilian uses of nuclear energy, not to military uses. We said that one could not protect the health and safety of employees or the public if one did not know what were the background levels of radiation, and one does not know what the background levels of radiation are if one does not measure the emissions from military uses of nuclear sites. And we said that as a full justification exercise had to be carried out, the regulator was bound to say that as Trident was in breach of these intransgressible principles, it was automatically a disbenefit, and on the disbenefit side of the equation, whereas the regulator, the Environment Agency, had automatically assumed that there was a benefit from what was going on because it involved decommissioning old warheads. We got somewhere with that argument in that we managed to split the Court of Appeal 1-1 with one of the judges sitting on the fence. Unfortunately, we were refused leave to go to the House of Lords, although not long afterwards that very question was decided by the European Court of Justice in a case, the Commission versus the UK, and I have to say, sadly, the European Court of Justice seemed to have made a political decision and said that actually the Euratom Treaty only applied to civilian uses of nuclear weapons. So that's one example of where nuanced arguments may be made which are more successful. The fourth lesson I've drawn is that there is no room for activists to think that they can succeed in advancing an argument that says the defence of necessity allows them to commit criminal damage to equipment or premises associated with the Trident weapon system. I'm not saying that those activists shouldn't advance those arguments. I am saying that they should do so in the clear understanding that if the judge or the court are aware of the House of Lords decision of a few weeks ago, then they are bound to fail. As I understand it, the argument goes like this. First, that the UK's policy of deterrence implies a threat to use Trident. Second, that a threat to use force that is illegal is in breach of Article 2.4 of the UN Charter. Third, that a threat to use Trident is in breach of the intransgressible requirement of the principle of distinction between competence and non-competence, or the principle of proportionality in the jus ad bellum. Fourth, as such, the UK's possession of Trident is an international crime. Fifth, an international crime becomes incorporated into domestic law and becomes part of our domestic law without anything further being required, and particularly without Parliament legislating. And lastly, accordingly, an activist is entitled to rely on the defence that he or she was using reasonable force in the prevention of a crime. Now, there are a number of problems with that argument. The first obvious problem is that one cannot point to the ICJ opinion to say that Trident does breach customary international law, and that therefore there is an international crime. The case I'm referring to was a case of the 29th of March 2006. It's the case of Margaret Jones. It's in the House of Lords, so it's the authoritative ruling on this. And it concerned a number of cases where activists had broken into bases, including RAF Fairford, in an attempt to stop the preparation of planes, etc., for bombing raids during the Iraq War. The activists in that case tried to argue that the crime of aggression under international customary law was an international crime and therefore incorporated into UK domestic law without anything further being required. That argument failed flat on its face. Lord Bingham referred to a passage from Sir Franklin Berman saying international law could not create a crime triable directly without the intervention of Parliament in an English court. They effectively said that this would be giving the executive far too much power, and the sky would fall in if this were so. And that is the position, and that will remain the position for the foreseeable future. And one of my messages to activists is that one needs to be much more subtle about how one puts these arguments. In the Fairford case, the activists argued that it was the crime of aggression that was part of customary international law that was automatically incorporated into UK domestic law. I wonder whether they would have got further if they'd argued that what they were interested in doing was stopping the war crime of dropping cluster bombs, which are inherently indiscriminate, and therefore breaching that intransgressible principle of international humanitarian law. The fifth and last lesson is that lawyers can and should be criticised for undue reliance on litigation. My view, and I'll expand on this afternoon, is that One needs to use international law in a much more creative way. We had an experience recently in the UK, which continues, where for the first time ever, whether or not a war was illegal or not became a matter of huge public debate. That public debate continues, and I believe it has done our Prime Minister, Tony Blair, enormous damage. The public debate about international law didn't just magically happen because the media decided this was interesting. It happened because civil society helped to make it happen. And I think that is the key to nuclear weapons. I think that in the UK, at least, the NGO community have manifestly failed to engage public consciousness in the key issue. The key issue being, how can we spend £35 to £40 billion of our money instead of spending it on education or health, when that activity is clearly unlawful? If one interrogates the facts of Trident in terms of its blast, heat, radiation effects, etc., rather than trying to extrapolate from the ICJ opinion some general principle about all nuclear weapons, one is left with the very clear conclusion that, of course, Trident could never be used in a way that was lawful. It is way too big. And that is the opinion of Professor Christine Chinkin and Rabinder Singh QC from December 2005. That, to me, is where our efforts as lawyers and activists should be focused, trying to get it through to the public in an ideological struggle, that what we're about to do is completely unlawful. I don't particularly see at the moment where litigation on these issues fits in to that struggle, because as I made clear at the beginning, I don't think that those issues, as head-on issues to a challenge to Trident, will be countenanced by a court. I think that what we need to do is engage with a more nuanced argument in what we might see as the court of public opinion. That's where I'll stop, and I'm going to pick up this afternoon what is the role of civil society, and in particular, its role in returning this question to the ICJ, or is that a good thing? Should we be thinking not of returning this to the ICJ? That's something that I'll pick up this afternoon. Thank you.
July 6th and 7th, 2006, under the title "Freedom from Nuclear Weapons."